what they have in Canada that the United States is driving is the single largest industrial project in world history. Mining an area essentially the size of Lake Superior, devastating an entire watershed, the Athabascan watershed, with CO2 emissions that are higher than 97 nations.
Welcome to the Sacred Land Film Project's audio archive, where we revisit the clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you more from our interview with Anishinaabe activist, environmentalist, and writer, Winona LaDuc. In 2011, I interviewed Winona for our Standing on Sacred Ground film series. The four-part documentary tells the stories of eight indigenous communities around the world fighting to protect their traditional territories, primarily from environmental harm. One episode, Profit and Loss, depicts the ecological disaster unfolding in remote northern Canada, in the homeland of the Chipewyan and Cree First Nations, the mining and processing of Alberta's tar sands, also known as oil sands. We needed Winona to put this massive industrial project in perspective. In part one of our audio archive, Winona discussed sacred places, the effects of Christianity, the revival of indigenous cultures, and the possibilities of apology and redemption. In this episode, we focus on her economic analysis of settler colonialism, consumer demand in the United States, and the rippling effects of the oil industry. Winona was personally connected to the tar sands story because for years she'd been fighting the expansion of the Enbridge Line 3 oil pipeline through her homeland, Anishinaabe territory in northern Minnesota. The oil flowing through that pipe originates in the boom towns of Fort McMurray and Fort McKay in Alberta, where environmental insults and social injustices are all being driven by what Winona sees as an unsustainable U.S. economy.
The U.S. consumes about 25% of the world's resources. Highly inefficient economy, based on consumption, not based on efficiency. In energy itself, between point of origin and point of use, wastes 57% of the power. Large consumers are rewarded by reduced prices. The oil economy is foundational to America's economy. And there's no plan B. That's to say your food travels 1,500 miles from farmer to table, in a truck, on a highway, with oil that we can't afford. Everything is transported around this country to a consumer economy, which is 70% of the U.S. economy, is consumption. That level of consumption is only buttressed by access to cheap oil. We peaked out a few years ago. What is left is hard to get. We have not tempered our level of consumption. The United States views Canada as some kind of domestic oil economy, apparently, although Canada is a different country. But the oil that is produced in the Alberta tar sands is destined for the United States. 80% of the oil in Minnesota today comes from the tar sands. The Canadian, American, French, Dutch interests in the oil sands, they are interested in that area because it is not the bottom of the ocean. It is not in the middle of a war zone. They're interested in this set of technology because once this technology is secured, they will replicate it on a worldwide scale, and we will have the evil and destruction that is occurring in the tar sands, occurring everywhere from, you know, Morocco to the Amazon to the Niger Delta. In a world with reduced access to petroleum that is based on a petroleum bubble, this is viewed as the expansion of the bubble. The interest of these corporations and these multitude of governments is predicated on the fact that they have not been enlightened or had enough foresight to create a reduced petroleum economy in the face of a absolute boundary on how much oil there actually is, which is retrievable. The interests in the tar sands are trying to expand their oil production. And what they are trying to do is to put in two pipelines. One's called XL and one is called Gateway. One goes to the Port of Vancouver, the other one goes to Houston. In all the advertising on national television and radio, it is always presented as if tar sands oil is going to reduce the price of U.S. oil and indeed provide more jobs. The reality is that the location of those two pipelines is for export markets, not for U.S. markets. And that's exactly what the documentation that was delivered to the Canadian authorities by the interests behind the tar sands says. There's a glut in the U.S. market. We want access to foreign markets. So Canada does not have the answer to America's rising gas prices. What they have in Canada that the United States is driving is the single largest industrial project in world history. Mining an area essentially the size of Lake Superior, devastating an entire watershed, the Athabascan watershed, with CO2 emissions that are higher than 97 nations. That level of destruction is entirely based on U.S. demand, on inefficiencies, on a set of choices which continue to be made to transport things that should not be transported. For instance, food produced at factory farms around the country. In the spectrum of oil, this is dirtiest. Oil that is begot from war is someplace in the same category. But ecologically, this is the dirtiest oil in the world because what they're doing is taking basically sand that's full of oil, putting chemicals in it, spinning it in a centrifuge with a bunch of water, and then shoving it into a pipeline. That discharge, that contamination of that ecosystem is going without challenge by the Canadian government. Because the Canadian government is entirely beholden to the oil revenues that are accrued from the Alberta tar sands. The antidote to the tar sands is, of course, relocalizing agriculture. It is reducing the transportation inefficiencies of an American economy that's predicated on gas. It's building a rail system that would not be an embarrassment to Bulgaria. And creating industry that is based on use, not on consumption. In other words, even the CURL project, which is the equipment to destroy the northern Alberta forest, is coming from Korea. Because they don't build anything in the United States, so we can't even build the death machines for the tar sands here. And so they got transported from across the world, try to take it up the Columbia River, cross Highway 12, Nez Perce Reservation, into Montana and up to the tar sands. That globalized world economy is precariously based on access to cheap oil, which does not, in fact, exist. And one of the greatest economic shames of the past 5 years is the fact that the U.S. has invested almost $200 billion in the tar sands. When that $200 billion, if invested in efficiencies, if invested in relocalizing food, energy, reducing a materials commodities economy, would put us in a place where we were not, as a U.S. economy, continuously at risk of the vagaries of world oil prices and complicit in the destruction of one ecosystem after another.
After this interview, Winona continued to fight U.S. investment in the tar sands. The two pipelines she mentioned, Keystone XL and Gateway, were stopped, in large part due to public opposition. But ultimately, Winona was not able to stop the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline through her homeland, which she blames on governments that are too focused on economic health.
The general model of a healthy economy is predicated on growth. that growth is predicated on the inefficient, continual consumption of natural resources, as if there is no end. It is opportunity for forever. The perfect example of that is the petroleum economy, which is not a petroleum age. It's a bubble. And in the short period of time that we've consumed it, we've consumed half the world's known oil resources. The remaining oil resources are still there, but they're in places that it is untenable or difficult to get, whether it is the Gulf of Mexico, 20,000 feet below the sea, up in the Arctic, polar ice caps, in the tar sands of Alberta, where you're basically turning bitumen or clay into the dirtiest oil in the world. It is something that you're going to stuff in your gas tank. Or whether it is in some country that might not want to give us their oil. Expensive wars. That is mirrored in the larger materials economy of, quote, natural resources. You have inefficient production systems, historically. A materials economy which is linear, consuming vast amounts, producing vast amounts of waste, and what remains produces more waste and is more toxic and is harder to get. Gold, of course, is the top standard of, how little remains and how much cyanide and how much destruction is caused, and exhibits and illustrates the problem because it is largely for luxury, unneeded. But yet you have an industrial society which feels entitled to continue to consume at this rate without becoming a reduced materials economy. And the consequences of that are that places that have been remote, that indigenous people have fought off industrialism or the military or multinational corporations for many years, they are now coming to those most remote places in the most egregious manners, violating all forms of international law. The Ramu nickel mine, perfect example of that, the tar sands of Alberta, these places where you could not do this if it was being regulated. But they are without regulation. They are above reproach. And you have increasingly, the multinational access where Chinese corporations, less and less ability to hold them accountable. If we thought we couldn't hold Exxon accountable, try holding the Chinese accountable. And so indigenous people are faced with the largest mining corporations in the world, have been for years. But now in these new terrain where what we will hope to do is to learn from the history elsewhere, whether it is Bougainville or from the battles against mining in this country, and ally with those peoples who are obviously tenacious. You can't hang around for this long and not be tenacious in the face of these, governments and corporations, and hope that through both, building alliances and using whatever political and legal and economic resources we have, we can support them in their struggle to keep, that which is the most sacred to them from being turned over for oil or turned over for a mine.
While the global economic interests of corporations may seem complicated, Winona has always been great at simplifying. For her, it's very clear whose interests governments protect, and it's definitely not the interests of indigenous people.
The United States, as a world economic power, although now owned by another world economic power, has always based its mythology of economics on that. The invisible hand of Adam Smith actually says Exxon on it. The idea that somehow there is this invisible market economy and there's a separation between government and corporation and that it's a healthy economy is predicated on a whole set of lies. That's the reality. The founding fathers were slaveholders and the economic foundations were multinational corporations, trading corporations. The building of empire in the United States was always predicated on government collusion with industrialists to take indigenous lands. Whether it was Weyerhaeuser, whether it was the railroads, or whether it was the oil companies. The government annexed the lands, the government gave them the lands, the government violated the treaties, the government killed the Indians. And sometimes the corporations did it too. But that's the history. And that history is worldwide. Of the development of the economies of nation-state corporation relationships that were at the expense of land and people who live there. In this era, it is continued. It must continue to the extent that they are required to have that relationship at some level. You cannot get to the native people without some sort of government collusion. I mean, you can, but it's a lot easier to have the government on your side. You know, to the extent in the United States, you have this trust responsibility, which is absolutely ignored, you know, in many of these cases, whether it is, you know, opening up all the uranium mines on the Navajo Reservation, or the lack of protection of sacred sites, although protected under executive order. In order to gain access, you have to have the government look the other way, or the government issue the leases and issue the permits. Canada is the worst case in the northern part. Well, you know, they're worse than the United States, I would say. That is to say, because Canada's economy over the past 60 years, 70 years, has evolved to be an economy in which the roads go north-south, the power lines go north-south, the pipelines go north-south. The United States externalizes its environmental impact. We saw that with the James Bay dams to Canada. And the Canadian government, in its empire mentality as an outpost of Britain, still views the North as a territory and the Indigenous people as disposable. And so that Staples economy, which was foundational to Canada's economy, remains their psyche. And in order to have this economy which exploits at that level, whether it is uranium mines over the backs and deaths of Indigenous people, or the tar sands, or dam projects that flood huge areas of land, you cannot have environmental laws with any reality in them. Instead, you have none. You have environmental practices which totally disregard what is going on. It's called the balance of convenience argument, which is, it is far more convenient to mine the North, to suck the North, you know, dry of oil, or to dam the North, so that the majority of the Canadian population, which lives very close to the U.S. border, can continue its lifestyle. And the trade agreements between the U.S. and Canada can continue unfettered by human rights or violations of the rights of nature.
To rationalize the comforts of our lifestyle, we tell ourselves that we're following a linear course of progress. Our response to the destruction of ecosystems is to hope that technology will save us. But Winona says that's all a fantasy, and it grows out of our failure to embrace the land we live upon.
I think that settler society, or society born of this empire, has a disconnect from the world. It is the nature of the transience of America that most generations today do not live in the same place as their parents or their grandparents. It is the psychology of the West, or the idea of the greener pastures, a state of mind. And so there is no connection to place. It is in its spiritual realm, the rapid transition of technology, to which I would suggest that technology has in itself become a religion. In that people believe that technology will save them. Whether it is carbon sequestration, a nuclear waste ferry, or genetically engineered foods. That mindset is not only dangerous, it is full of a lie. And in that lie, there is a justification for denying real power. And the fact that the only way to sequester carbon is to not take it out. The only way to not have nuclear contamination at nuclear power plants or nuclear waste or nuclear weapons is to leave the uranium in the ground. And the only way to ensure that your water will be good is to care for it, not contaminate it. Corporate military culture has no repertoire for showing it cleans up before it makes a mess. We have no experience. We have dead rivers, dead zones, tailings ponds, radioactive waste dumps, oil spills. So any suggestion that technology will save us has not thus far been illustrated. Will they develop cleaner technology? We would hope so. But they still haven't cleaned up what we already have, which is an ecological disaster. The amount of money that is expended in that trajectory or that scorched earth path could have been spent on reducing the need for that horrendous project. And so that set of choices and opportunities thus far forgone has placed us in this position we are now. But that disconnect plus the distance that is buttressed by a petroleum bubble means that people don't see where their water comes from, don't know where their food comes from, don't know where life comes from. And in this climate-controlled consumer world in which many Americans live, and increasing numbers of people elsewhere aspire to live, there is a bubble which surrounds, in which people believe that nothing else is essential. And somehow their needs will always be met. The bubble is fictitious. And that just because you can go from your air-conditioned car to your air-conditioned house does not mean that climate change does not exist. And so, you know, consciousness comes from being real. And consciousness, unfortunately for some, will occur when they can't afford their air conditioning or they are sick from their surroundings.
Winona is always working to snap us out of our bubble, urging each of us to see and feel the true cost of our consumer society. Perhaps too many of us feel too entitled to the lifestyle we've grown accustomed to face the reality of the impact we're having on Mother Earth.
You know, in the politically correct end, the presumption that you should have access to omega-3 vitamins from the Arctic and goji berries are an example of a whole foods entitlement. That you should be able to get organic kiwis or organic anything from anywhere else in the world is a set of entitlements and a practice. In the less upper class organic department, the presumption that you can go over and plug in, that you will always have power, that you can have a set of appliances that you do not need in your house to create more gadgetry for convenience that required more materials to make and that will end up in a garbage dump in 3 years, is entitlement. The perception that you should get a new cell phone every time there is a new cell phone plan is the current example of entitlement. The presumption or assessment that the rest of the world should provide for us because we have the money. They say that each of our households basically has the equivalent of 100 slaves working for it. Our level of consumption, whether it is from energy to food to material possessions, pretty much unsustainable over the long haul. North Americans feel that, you know, we got the money, which it turns out we've borrowed from China at this point. And so if you have the money, you should get what you want.
Just as consumers today feel entitled to material goods, early colonizers felt entitled to name the lands and prominent places they came upon. Winona points out that while it may seem merely symbolic to reclaim and rename these places, it can bring about the consciousness change we need.
In the process of expansion of empire, there's often this putting a flag on it, sticking a claim on it, and the naming. This is one of my objections to colonialism, Americanism, settler society, which is the naming of large mountains after small men. And the idea that you take the place where, you know, the Anishinaabe witnessed the Thunder Beings rest in their migration from west to east near the city of Thunder Bay, and you call it Mount McKay, where the Lakota call it the heart of the Black Hills, Harney Peak. Or in, you know, Aboriginal territory, you know, Ayers, I don't know who Ayers was. Some guy who blew through, got a big rock named after him. And in the deconstruction of empire and the entitlement that is associated with it, it's essential to let go. And that letting go releases places from names that have no relevance and gives us an opportunity to remember or learn or relearn about the sacredness of the place and what its meaning, its history is, and its own essence before they were all so badly named. You see the recovery of these places, though, and more consciousness is returning. In the United States, it was Mount McKinley to Mount Denali. Yeah, that transformation. Ayers Rock, now Uluru. You see, I mean, some guys didn't even just get a rock named after them. They got a country. Cecil Rhodes, the Rhodes Scholar guy, he got Rhodesia. And they call it Zimbabwe, you know. And then I think it's Queen Charlotte Island. Recently, recovered name, Haida Gwaii. So there is this process of deconstructing the colonial naming, which is occurring. I'm pretty sure that they didn't need a lot of, you know, counseling in Australia when they change it back to its right name. And I'm hoping, you know, Mount Denali definitely didn't. So I'm hoping that that could continue because somehow that process, although it is just in the realm of words, it still offers this return to consciousness and places people in a more realistic relationship to land instead of having large sacred mountains named like Mount Graham, yeah, you know, or San Francisco Peaks. I'm pretty sure that St. Francis was never there, yeah. Having these places named after these people, you know, to put us back in the perspective that we are, which are those who travel through, live here a short time. The mountains precede, will be here long after we're gone. And they are sacred beings unto themselves. I think that we are seeing some of that and we need more.
One of the most hopeful stories in Standing on Sacred Ground is that of the Native Hawaiians who won the island of Kaha'olawe back into indigenous hands after 50 years of bombing by the U.S. Navy. When I asked Winona to help frame that story, I was surprised to learn that she had visited the island in the early 1980s.
So I was 21, 22 at the time, and I had never been to Hawaii. I went to Oahu, and then I went to Maui, and then we went to Kaha'olawe, so that was the third island I was ever at. I didn't know what to expect. I know that they kind of threw us off the boat, and it was dark. And so as a land lake person, I had to overcome my fear. But I remember landing in this place that what you felt was that there was this place that had a great holiness that was faced with a great set of grievances and injustice. And you saw these people who, at that time, the military still controlled the island, but it was access. So it was early, and these people were determined to recover their relationship to that place. And they're very courageous. I remember that, and I remember that we walked far, and we did their ceremonies with them. And then I remember seeing the craters, and I remember seeing the artillery shells. And I remember them saying how they were cleaning it up, and that was the first time I ever was at a military bombing range. where I saw the expanse of the destruction. That's just, you know, a microcosm of what the military does to indigenous lands everywhere. It's alarming, you know, because it is out of sight, it is out of mind, it is above reproach, it is shielded from most environmental regulation, and it continues at this level, which is astounding, you know, particularly because the United States military dwarfs any other military in the world, and there's no need to test that much more, you know. So for me, it was this moment of, I grew up in a family that was opposed wars, and it was this moment of seeing the impact of war on land to me, and the impact of war on sacred places, and caused hurt in me. And I, you know, I cannot imagine because I'm not from there, but I understood the significance of that place and what they were doing to those people.
While Winona was deeply moved by her experience on Kaho'olawe, she's noticed that non-Indigenous people often find it hard to relate to stories of First Peoples and their sacred lands.
I find it ironic, you know, that Americans study ancient Greek history and are fascinated by stories from Europe and knights, and but have never seen those places. And yet, when you bring forth an equally magnificent set of stories based on place that maybe has never seen the light of day in their memory or in their school, it is not valued as such. We should care about the greatness of creation because we are human. And our humanity is reaffirmed in that richness.
Many of the communities we visited in the Standing on Sacred Ground series demonstrated the significant biological diversity on lands protected by Indigenous people. We visited a potato farm in Peru where they used to grow 60 or 70 varieties of potatoes, but in 2007, they only had 33 varieties left due to climate change. Winona points out that this is not just a loss of biodiversity, but a loss of relationship.
There is this perception that species that do not adapt perish, and cultures that do not adapt perish. There is a relationship between cultural diversity and biological diversity. And the reality is that it is not a natural evolution which causes the destruction of peoples or the destruction of species. The theories, Darwin's theories of evolution, even as applied to social evolution, have no merit. Because these are man-made catastrophes which cause destruction of people and crashing of ecosystems and climate change. What one can hope in the best is that whether it is the Hawaiians with their 150 varieties of taro or kalo, or the multitude 400 or so varieties of potato, that somehow in the agrobiodiversity that exists, which is plants that are adapted by humans and human free will and relationship between human and relative, that those humans will be able, in fact, to adapt those plants so that they can keep eating. And the only peoples that are going to be able to do that are those people, because they know their plants, they know their ecosystem, and they know their prayers and their songs that keep those relatives growing.
Today, governments and corporations are being forced to face the consequences of economic policies that constantly seek unlimited growth. The COVID pandemic had a particularly detrimental effect on the oil industry, as the price of oil plummeted while all of us were sheltering in our homes. At the start of the pandemic, I had the opportunity to interview Winona again, this time on Zoom. As always, she saw the potential for a new world, while at the same time, she was out on the front lines trying to block the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline's new path from the Alberta tar sands through her homeland in northern Minnesota. She described our current system as Wendigo economics, referring to the mythic Anishinaabe spirit, Wendigo, whose failure to control its insatiable hunger can lead it to cannibalism, consuming even Mother Earth. Winona saw this in the Anishinaabe prophecy regarding a choice between two paths.
The prophecy says this is the time of the seventh fire, and that we have a choice between two paths. One path, they say, is well-worn but scorched, and the other path is not well-worn and it's green. You know, and it's be our choice which path to embark on. And then they say, you know, there's this discussion about the lighting of the eighth fire, which is this time of peace and harmony. You know, and I feel like that you got to go out there and do it and light the fire. You can't like sit there at the crossroads and go, I don't know. It's time to birth the next economy. It's time to, like, I consider myself a doula. You need a lot of doulas. You know, there's this intersection between the Russian-Saudi price war on oil, the, you know, incredible greed of Wendigo economics of this, we're just going to try to get as much out of that tar sands as we can and get everybody to pay for it and subsidize it, you know, $82 a barrel. And these guys always act like they're so smart, but you and I know that they're not so smart. We've been fighting pipelines for a long time here, and Enbridge is super desperate. I'm sitting there, and I don't want to cry for the tar sands oil producers, but minus $37 a barrel is not a good price for oil. I'm 60 years old. You know, I'll go throw down with all them other fine Minnesotans who throw down. I'm a water protector. But for crying out loud, you want to shoot me for a Canadian corporation? Really? You know, you want to shoot a bunch of 60-year-old women for a Canadian pipeline company? Come on, Governor Wolf. This is called the end of the fossil fuel era, and that's what it looks like. Time to move on. Let's go solar. Use less. Ride your bike.
In January of 2021, Winona and two other water protectors were arrested and charged with trespassing, harassment, unlawful assembly, and public nuisance after police saw a social media video of them protesting at an Enbridge pipeline construction site near the Mississippi River. But this past September, the judge noted that they were exercising their right to free speech, and she threw out the charges against Winona and her co-defendants, saying, quote, to criminalize their behavior would be the crime. To listen to more from our 2011 interview with Winona LaDuke, visit our website for part one, where Winona breaks down the indigenous worldview and the harms of colonization. You can find that episode at sacredland.org, along with our full audio archive, as well as films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt Wong and Toby McLeod. Our interview with Winona LaDuke was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger in collaboration with co-producer Jennifer Huang and writer Jessica Abbey. This episode is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in Lejeune Ohlone Territory in Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.